Do you know what it takes to have great sex? It's simple. Contraceptives. Visit findmymethod.org to learn how you can protect yourself during sex. Because safe sex is the best sex.
Welcome to the Feminist Bar Podcast with your host, Tina Tsuemaka. Join me for drinks and chats with feminists all over the world across background, sexuality, and discipline to talk about all things life through our radical feminist lens. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are listening from, whatever time you are listening. Welcome to the Feminist Bar Podcast with your host, Tina. I'm back again with a guest that we've had earlier this season who is an ultimate fave to talk about like very important information. Hey sis, what's happening? Her name is Fiona, aka at Vashiela. How you doing?
Hi Tina, thank you for having me. So great to be back.
So good to have you back. I actually have a question for you, which is that, you know, and this is because I was just like looking at the numbers like again today. I remember telling you like, I think last week that like your episode had like the most downloads of like a certain period of time. And I was just thinking like, that was interesting to me because I don't think that people gravitate towards like educational information. And just looking at the trend, right, I see that like people are kind of self-interested. Sorry guys, if you're listening, I'm not dragging you anything. But people are kind of self-interested, which is why things about dating and like friendships are like buzzwords that always, like, even if we're talking about spaces, headlines, whatever, they get a lot of views and they get a lot of engagement, whereas like, for example, like academic papers or like podcasts don't really get that much, like, but then in terms of like this podcast and in terms of like our episode previously on public health and feminism in public health, like, why do you think it was like super downloaded? Do you think it was just like your network that was like pulling through?
That's a good question. I hadn't even thought about it. Probably. I think that at least on my Twitter, I'm very intentional about having a lot of people who are interested in public health. So a lot of the people I follow who follow me are in the field or at least interested in the field. And then also because I am obviously a feminist, I also follow a lot of feminist creators and like people who are constantly talking, having these kind of like conversations and discourse. So I probably, it's like an intersection of both. So it's kind of like a best of both worlds scenario that probably happened. That's my like first thought. My second thought is probably that this is just me being biased. I don't know. But I do think that public health or just like health in general, because of the pandemic, has really kind of been on the spotlight more than it had been maybe in the past 5-10 years.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people are thinking about, a lot of feminists or a lot of people who are interested in feminism and like activism and thinking about social issues, right, are seeing how this kind of like spills over into other facets of our lives. So this was probably just a good start to kind of have these conversations and tie them either into people's careers or people's interests, or just see how, you know, we're not like, and I think like you're right that like, I feel like dating and all those things are important and they are at like at the personal level. But like when we talk of public health, it the personal builds into public health, right? So seeing that connection of like the choices I'm for, like the choices or like, you know, whatever episodes you've had before, and then see that tie into actual, you know, potential like health outcomes or people's health status is probably an interesting thing. People might just want to click and listen maybe.
I definitely agree about what you've just said about like public health and the pandemic. And I think I was literally, because I was recording an episode just before this, and I was saying, you know, I really thought that season two would be a lot about, you know, self-development, like personal and professional development, but it's kind of had like this public health takeover because outside of like this episode and the episode that we did,
this is the universe telling you to join the dark side.
It seems as though 5 of like 10 of the season 2 episodes are public health episodes. So that's like, that's a pretty big like number, 50%. But yeah, so today we are here to talk to you about sexual health, in particular, sexually transmitted infections, the numbers around that, why this is a feminist issue, why women's health is a feminist issue, why it's a public health issue, and, you know, I guess raise a little bit of awareness about that. And the first question, I'm just going to get right into it, is why is this an important public health issue? I'm going to let you take it away.
Thanks, Tina. Yeah, so for sexually transmitted infections, right? STIs, as most people know them. Previously, I think people would refer to them as STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, but we've since, you know, learned that it goes beyond the disease as it presents itself, but sometimes it's just infections that lay latent in people's bodies. So these are an important thing to talk about and think about for multiple reasons, the main reason really just being the scale, the sheer scale of the issue. For context, I am just like pulling out some stats that I've been looking at from the WHO, from their most recent report on STIs and sexually transmitted infections, where we find that each year there are an estimated 376 million new infections of the top 4 STIs. And these 4 are like chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and trichomoniasis, I can never say that word. But yeah, so of the top 4 STIs, excluding HIV, we find that we have close to 400 million new infections a year. And for people who, like, as a comparison to kind of get people's gauge on what that means or how big that is, currently since the beginning of the COVID pandemic in 2020, the current like count of total cases is 215 million, right? And some change. So since 2020, and COVID is a global pandemic that we're currently like all hands on deck, we're trying to figure this out. And in a space of about a year and a half, we've had 215 million cases. HIV, which is another pandemic that we've had since the 80s and has kind of become a little bit more endemic. And imagine like just kind of like the sheer impact HIV has had in the past 30 years, total prevalence to date is like 35, 36 million. Since at the beginning, of course, with HIV, it's a little bit biased. They're looking at that number because a lot of people unfortunately passed away, similar to COVID. But to think of those just two numbers as a reference and then think that, you know, approximately 400 million people are getting infected with STIs every year globally, it shows you that a lot of people are getting this, but somehow it's not really on the forefront. It's not really on the forefront of people, what people are talking about or thinking about. Yeah, so that's the first reason I'd say it's an important public health issue. The second reason why it's important is that when people get infected with, you know, whether it's a bacterial or viral sexually transmitted infection, it also increases risk for other infections. So it's a risk for a lot of these, like syphilis, for example, is a risk for co-infection with HIV. So you find that there's a lot of intersections then with other, you want to call them pandemics or other diseases or other issues of public health interest, right? So not only a person getting infected with an STI is an issue about their personal health, but then they could get infected with something that needs more treatment and care. So you have like more of like double burden, if you want to think of it that way. And then another issue, another reason why this is very important is that a lot of these sexually transmitted infections is either bacterial, viral, or parasites. And basically the way the WHO thinks of it is like there are over 30 types of ways you could get it, but they're usually 8 top pathogens. And of those 8, the 4 that I read out before are, some of 4 of those are curable. Like you can actually, like, for example, if you have chlamydia, you go in, you get your medication, and you don't have chlamydia anymore. But the other four, you kind of have them for life. So if you were to get HIV, if you have human papillomavirus, if you have herpes simplex virus, so the other four are not curable. So you need treatment and continuous care throughout your life. So when we think of like quality of life and care that people need, you know, it's kind of like 50-50 between like getting an STI, and sometimes people are co-infected between the two. And with these treatments, there's also a risk where you have antibiotics as treatment, you also have risk for drug resistance. So getting an STI that then is resistant to the current line of treatment, which means you kind of have to wait for the science to catch up. Similarly to what's happened with COVID, right? People are doing that trend with the variants, right? The same thing with STIs, there are variants of it. And the variants are smarter and outsmarting the treatment that's currently there. So if we don't continuously try to work to fix this, we're just at risk of creating perpetuating these infections that we won't know what to do with them in the future.
Yeah. That's a lot of people. I've just been thinking about the number. It's like the number has been ringing in my
head.
But you are absolutely right about people not having enough conversations around, I mean, even if I want to just kind of take it down to a more like interpersonal level, the way that we interact with people and the way people are just so like careless and casual and nonchalant about, for example, like not using protection or not needing protection or not knowing enough about their bodies or their status. And you know, obviously there's a large chunk of people that are outside of the population I'm talking about, because I'm just talking about, for example, like in my circles or the people that I've been exposed to like in my life. And I know that there's a whole other like population of people that for other reasons might not know. But just thinking about that on this end, I'm just like, you know, even when people make jokes on Twitter about like, oh, you guys wear condoms, I'm like, that's not funny.
Like,
that's not funny. The joke is not slapping as much as it used to slap.
No, because this stuff is real, and you're right that like at an interpersonal level, like I was just trying to think when you were talking, like I can, for example, and there's probably a number of reasons why that is, right? But at the top of your head, you probably, you know, because we were, like by we I mean younger millennials, we were born, especially in the African context, we were born and raised during the time of the HIV pandemic. So everyone kind of, you at least are 1 or 2 degrees removed from someone who's HIV positive, right? If you're in any African country, most likely, right? Your mom probably had HIV, or your uncle or your friends. Or you, right? Because like, it's just like, and even currently, I think the statistic for young people is like 1 in 4 new infections right now are in adolescent women, are in adolescents, and women are more exposed as well. So it's kind of, HIV is kind of like in our face. We know it, we've been talking about it, but yeah. I can't at the top of my head think of, and there's, I mean, privacy is also very important, but I can't, I don't know anybody who has chlamydia. So I'm like, I'm looking at the statistic and I'm like, how is it 400 million people in the world have it? And I've never heard it any like, and HIV, we're moving toward, like, we're moving away from stigma, right? So HIV is very, there's still very stigmatized, but people talk about it and we know about it, but zero conversation about, oh, I had to go get tested before I slept with this guy, or he got tested and we're currently on treatment, or this happened. No conversation whatsoever. And I think that's part of the issue itself, is that it's definitely there. That's what the data is telling us, but somehow it's like invisible. You know, that's why you will find a lot of like text referring to it as like a silent epidemic.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Like, that was just so funny. Like, you're like, well,
no, do you know somebody with gonorrhea? Like, is anybody ever just, oh, I was like, out sick last, you know, I had the clap.
Like, guys, the numbers are saying that we have this, but apparently none of you has it. So what's the truth?
Right.
Yeah. What's happening? How do we fix it if we're never talking about it? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to move on like to the next question, which is really like my favorite question of today's episode, which is,
why is this a feminist issue? So, you know, why is sexual health a feminist issue? And I think, you know, even without having a public health background, I can say off the top of my head, like, women have always had a low status in society, lack of autonomy, constantly being policed about their bodies, which means that there's this huge stigma, probably that, you know, sexually transmitted infections are for a certain type of woman or are for a certain type of promiscuity. And which then, like, is why, for example, like, sex workers struggle so much, like, with access. Stop me anytime if I'm lying.
No, you're just kidding. No, keep going.
And, you know, outside of that, just like the idea that, like, sexually transmitted infections are caused by sex, I know is probably like a huge thing that you could also, like, tell us more about. And, you know, which is crazy. Like, what's crazy to me is, like, the whole promiscuity and, you know, sexually transmitted infections, you know, being something of, you know, promiscuous women and, you know, sex workers and, you know, women that behave like this, women that behave like that. When I was actually, like, reading yesterday, when I was doing, like, this research for this episode, that, like, the primary, like, transmitters of sexually transmitted infections is men. Like, that's, I hate patriarchy so much. Like, what is that about?
It's everything, man.
Patriarchy is like the lies for me. Patriarchy has just been lying for centuries. Everything is a lie. Like,
you're so on point. You're so on point with that. And for me, I was ruminating on this as well all weekend, and just, like, for me, it really goes back to, right, their sexually transmitted infections. It goes back to sex. And you know that I was just thinking, I was like, people be gay, people be having sex. Like, I was thinking about it's just the stigma around sex in of itself, our ability to talk about it, even when we're having it, and our ability to be educated about it. And that's so layered on so many levels, right? Because even when I was plowing through the WHO data, there is some disproportionality in terms of, like, maybe the Africa region had, like, more. And even when I tried to look at data disaggregated by gender or, like, age, unfortunately, they mostly had data for adults. So trying to think about, like, is it mostly affecting women? Is it mostly affecting young women? Is it mostly affecting, you know, I think currently the common language in the literature is around, like, key populations. So they flag, like you say, sex workers, they flag men who have sex with men, they flag young people, women, right? So those are the key populations that tend to be affected. And there's also, and by being key populations, it's not just about being affected, but it's also about not having access to care. And therefore, when you don't have access to care, that predisposes you to all the other things we talked about, like the co-infection with HIV. And then there's also the issue of, like, when women, in terms of women's reproductive health, when women get infected with STIs, in general, the biology of STIs tends to be that by the time you figure out that something is wrong, it's already, like, been there for a while. So the symptoms tend to come out late. And we know with infectious diseases, the longer it takes for a case to present, the more problematic it is, because the more likely you are to spread it, one. And then for women especially, even when you look at case presentations for, like, syphilis, for gonorrhea, it takes longer, like, to show symptoms. And by the time you're showing the symptoms, there's probably a host of other things going on that need attention. And you find that even spills over to pregnant women. So you have a lot of babies being born with these sexually transmitted infections. You have a lot of babies being born with congenital issues because their mom was pregnant and had an STI, but never got checked. Or by the time they found out that they had this, it was already too late. So it's a problem for so many reasons, right? Then it's not just the women themselves, it's the children they give birth to. And also, like you're saying, that the stigma around, like you were saying, who gets to have sex? Who gets to openly have sex? Who gets to, like, when someone has an STI? I know of a lot of, like, anecdotally, like, growing up, even in Zim, people don't even call them STIs. There's a general term for it. People say sick, angani sick. And I remember asking my mom when I was like, what is that? Right? And it's like, is this a catch-all phrase for STI. And even then it was like hush hush in families. And but you know, when someone is in, like in Zim, I remember, I don't know if that's still the case, but at some point they had to try to kind of like come at this issue. They had kind of like stipulated this rule that if you're a woman, because women do tend to seek medical care more than men and go in for checkups for various reasons. You have a baby, you go for your 3 month or 4 month checkup for the baby, you get tested and you find out you have an STI. They were refusing to, nurses would refuse to treat women until you come in with your partner. And then by doing so, they're trying to stop the spread, because then we give you medication, we give your partner medication, and then we stop, kind of like curb the spread, right? The same way we do for COVID, where it's like you test positive, you're isolated so that we stop the spread. But then that also has its problems, because typically in a lot of like heteronormative like partnerships, when, like you said, it's the men that are spreading it. So even if, yeah, like the men is sleeping with multiple people and not necessarily the woman as well. So it doesn't really cover it all, but then it comes out, the burden of the pandemic or the burden of the disease is on the women. It's on the women like going into the hospital and having to explain that I have an unfaithful partner. Or it's on the women to actually go back and have the conversation of like, hey, you need to get checked because somebody in this relationship is not being faithful, right? So it was like for a lot of public health issues, a lot of issues when we have diseases and things like that, even if they proportionally affect men and women, when they are sexual of nature, when they tend to be for reproductive health reasons, the burden and stigma and the moral bearing falls on the marginalized groups. And that's more often women, that's more often people, you know, who are LGBTI, it's more often sex workers, as we see. And that's why you see in literature, they're trying to kind of bring those populations back up and try to say, okay, everyone's getting affected, but these people tend to get affected more. So what can we do to help them?
Yeah. Just like on the topic of what, you know, I guess I'm going to say like patriarchy and masculine order has done to sex is kind of mind blowing to me, because on one hand, you have women's bodies, women's black bodies constantly being scandalized. And on the other end, you have sex being this thing that is not supposed to be spoken about, so much so that it even affects the way in which sexual assault and sexual crimes are reported, not only in our homes, but even if you go to the courts and prosecution at the judiciary, the way that people treat sexual crimes, it's like the victim is always the person who must be ashamed. Like, wow, why are you talking about this? And mm-hmm. You know what? I'm just like, you just like opened like a can of worms in my head, just thinking
because like, even in that scenario you're talking about, right? It's, yeah, that's just patriarchy. That's just how it happens. Because in this case, if you have a woman who's a victim of assault, they're speaking up, but somehow the burden falls on them. And then that has a lot of repercussions on them. And where's the men in the conversation? Who knows? It's the same thing with sexual health, is that women tend to be the ones that present with these infections, but men are rarely involved in the conversation.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I love like talking about everything from a feminist issue. And I remember once upon a time when I decided I would make everything a feminist issue after I heard from someone, because I was like, oh, I don't think I can apply for that. Like, they listed that they want people that do this, this, this. And they're like, yeah, you bring this, this, this with a gender perspective, because we need one literally for everything. And I was just like, yeah. You could be in any space and it would be a space to make it about gender, because there's always time to, whether we're talking about, like, even if we're like, just to like be far off talking about food insecurity, we could still be talking about gender. But anyway, I'm going to move on to the next question, the last question, which is, what can we do about this crisis?
Yeah, thank you for calling it a crisis, because it really is. This was the hardest part for me, because I felt like I'm a little bit removed from the work, as in terms of like on the actual ground. But potential solutions or like points of action, I think the one thing everyone can do is talk about sex. Let's keep talking about sex, guys. Talk about sex on your dates, talk about sex everywhere, because like at the heart of like people staying for 6 months, like if you see some of the horror photos that come out of like people losing their limbs and their genitals after having STIs, it's because people are afraid to speak up and go seek care, because there's this stigma of like, if I go, then people will know that I had sex. But guess what? People are having sex. The world has been growing because people are having sex, right? But somehow there's this huge stigma around sexual activity to begin with. And then it also then spills over into a stigma around when people do test positive, whether it's HIV, whether it's herpes or whatever it is, right? There's a stigma. There's similar to how there's stigma with HIV or with COVID now, right? You feel the need to not share when you have it because people will look at you some type of way. And I think the best way to kind of shed off that stigma and that weight around the subject is to just make it the same way we say, oh, it's hot today. It's like, oh my God, I had the best sex last week. You know, and it's like, oh, that's great. Did you guys use protection? Or like, did you guys get screened before it? Normalize how we approach it and remove the stigma around sex, I think would be a great space for like everyone, whatever level of power you have, right? For me, that's the first step. And then the second step, I think for people who either work in education or work in healthcare or people who are activists and or content creators and things like that is like, lobbying for me, it goes back to the comprehensive sex ed piece of like in high schools and universities and in a lot of spaces, actually giving people the information and access to resources and knowing that if you have these kind of symptoms, sis, it's not just an itch anymore. Go see a nurse, go see a doctor. There are these kind of sexual clinics that can offer these services for free. Unfortunately, I've been a wanderer. So I really, like, for example, even where I'm based currently, I don't know what the top three sexual clinics are available in Kigali. I don't know if there are any, and if there are, which ones are free. I'm not particularly sure. So I feel like that's a resource that every, especially young women, especially like people who, like men who have sex with men, sexual workers, those like typically marginalized populations should really have this information in their back pocket to know where they can reach out and get access to resources in the event that they might think they might have it or need to get checked for it.
I was going to say that if you are in Zimbabwe and you are looking to get an STI screening, you can go to Population Services in Belvedere. If you just Google Population Services Harare, they will pop up. And in the meantime, I will also figure out any other places where you can get tested. Oh, if you are queer, gays and lesbians of Zimbabwe, gals, they can usually organize a screening for you. And I'm not sure where exactly they do that, but I'm pretty sure that they have like designated doctors that work with queer folk. And if you have also ever been to an HQ Collective event, you know that they definitely have some, just check out their Instagram page, HQ Collective. They will usually have just kind of like some resources or some referrals of queer friendly doctors in different areas. And I actually have used one of those referrals. I once got referred to a GP who is queer friendly. So they can also, I think, yeah, they can connect you to some people who might be able to do some screenings. And yeah, so sis, do you have any like last words for the people?
Get screened, guys. Just if you can afford to, I'd say, for women, first of all, this I've been saying, and I am so guilty of this, but if you're a woman under 30, you should be getting your swab for cervical cancer at the very least every 3 years. And then they recommend that, you know, post 40, you should be doing that annually because your risk for cervical cancer increases. And we know these STIs, HPV is the one that leads to cervical cancer. So get checked, get screened. And not just for HPV, but make it a habit the same way it's recommended to go to the dentist twice a year. I would recommend just like for the sake of it, try once a year, every 6 months if you can. If you're already on health insurance, it's already covered, guys. Go get screened. If you're entering into a new relationship or sexual interaction, and if you know, like you people, we know each other, like you know yourself more than anybody else. If you know you're not always going to wear that condom, girl, like get screened, like ask your partner to get checked before everything. Like, we just know ourselves, guys. I feel like the other thing is like, honestly, with ourselves. And we're not going to stigmatize, right? We're just going to be like, just be real with yourself. If you know your condom use is below 90%, get screened with every new partner. And even then, while continuously with the same partner, try to make it a quarterly habit. Every 6 months, go check. Because you don't know that that STI screening result is only as valid probably in the next couple of hours after you get it. Because you don't know where your partner's been. You don't know how they're moving. So just make it a habit, the same way we brush our teeth, the same way we wear seatbelts. You know, those are all public health preventative measures. It's the same way we should normalize talking about sex, knowing where these resources are available, getting screened and getting comfortable to taking good care of our sexual health. And nobody else can do it for us but ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I'm with it. Thank you for that. I think I am actually due for a full screening and definitely a cervical cancer one as well. Is that involved in a full screening?
I don't, it just depends with the, like some countries I know now include cervical, but you might have to request for it depending on the country and the city, yeah.
Yeah, because in Zim, that's not, okay.
No,
yeah. But thank you so much for being here for this episode. This was super educational, as I expected it to be. So thank you so much for, you know, just being such a reliable source of information who is helping, you know, women understand more about their public health and, you know, their health.
It's our health. It's like, it's, thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to talk about these issues. And creating a space where I can like freely nerd out about public health and feminism.
Thank you so much. Okay, that is a wrap on the episode. And that's a season, baby. That's a motherfucking season. That was the last episode of season 2 of the Feminist Bar podcast. And I just want to say a huge shout out, a huge thank you to everybody that has been listening. I want to say a huge thank you to everybody who has sent through the coffees. You're listening to this podcast. You're recommending this podcast. You're adding this podcast is everything that has led to its success. Everything that has led to the sponsorship that came this season. Everything that has led to all the other opportunities and the professional development that I have gotten from this fantastic platform. I really do this for the conversation. I said it. I do it for you, but I mostly do it for me. And I love you guys so much. I'm going to be taking a bit of a break, a week or two, maybe 3, before I get back to it. And I'm going to be bigger and I'm going to be better in season 3. We're going to have fantastic conversations. I love you so much. Thank you for listening. And I'll catch you next season. Interact with me on @TheFeministBar Podcast on Twitter and on Instagram. I love you all.